I'm glad to be with you. Thanks for having me, man. It's always a pleasure to do your show.
Oh, well, that's so kind of you. So we got 10 historical myths that we want to go through. Now, so give us, we each got five. Start with what you think is your number five historical myth. We'll save the best for last.
So I think the easiest one to debunk, at least on my list, is probably domino theory. This is, your listeners are probably familiar with it. This was the idea that if one country falls to communism, that all the neighboring countries will also fall to communism. And this was used to justify 60,000 American deaths in Vietnam. And it's so easy to debunk because we could see the product of all that today. Some of the most capitalist countries in the world are in Southeast Asia, like Singapore and Japan and the Philippines and stuff like that, where there actually is more of a free market than there is in America. So number five on my list is domino theory, just based on the mere simplicity of refuting it.
So that is another one where it's like it's still used today, even though it's a historical myth that, well, if we don't get them where they're at now in Afghanistan, then they'll go to Iraq. And then Iran is the number one funder of terrorism. So it's amazing that they can still cripple us with these sorts of deceptions. What would you say to someone who says, all right, well, it wasn't true then, but it is generally true now? As bad as America can be, we still have evils in the world that are China, Russia. If we are not the superpower, they will be. How do you respond?
Well, it's always the same old, same old. It's always the same excuses for war making. They just recycle them. You know, I'm sure you could probably, if we dug through the historical lexicon, I'm sure we could find examples from the War of 1812 and the Mexican-American War of these same sort of excuses. So whatever the excuses for war, frankly, it's irrelevant because obviously warfarism is immoral. So whatever the excuse is, we know right off the bat that it's wrong. This one happens to be the simplest one because if Canada does something, does that mean that we're going to fall in line too? Or if Mexico does something, are we going to fall in line too? People just buy into the indoctrination. They've been so brainwashed by the public schools that they're very easily victimized by these politicians. And to me, the idea that just because your neighbor behaves a certain way, you're going to behave a certain way, is just pure nonsense. Pure nonsense. Really, it's just logic and common sense that you need to debunk it.
Do you have any opinions on what just war theory would be? Because I'm thinking of, you know, if A is assaulting B and I don't know either of them, is it okay if I intervene? Well, yeah. And that's because I'm stopping an aggressor from aggressing, even though I don't know them and I don't have a dog in the fight. I'd say that's justified. The difference is I'm not involving civilians and I'm not coercively funding it. Do you have any ideas on just war theory in a free society?
Yeah, I think Rothbard has one of my favorite lectures by Rothbard is called America's Two Just Wars. And essentially the argument that he puts forward is that the only war is one fought in response to statist aggression. So according to Rothbard, the only two just wars America ever fought was one, the colonists fighting the revolution, and two, the Southerners fighting off the Unionists. And I couldn't agree with him more. I also like the idea of the Christian just war theory, although I'm not the most religious individual in the world, but I do like that idea. You're not supposed to initiate aggression upon anyone. You have the right to self-defense, of course, but that's it. There is never, ever, ever an excuse for the initiation of violence, particularly in terms of the state who is already an illegitimate entity. So to me, a just war is one fought against the state, and that's it.
Sure. My first myth of history comes to us from Bert Folsom, who wrote this really good book, but he just has this historical insight that I'm a little disappointed I never made, and it took me reading this book. He says, right away, this separates two groups of entrepreneurs, those who sought subsidies and those who didn't, those who tried to succeed in the steamboating industry primarily through federal aid, pools, vote buying, or stock speculation, we classify as political entrepreneurs. Those who tried to succeed in steamboating primarily by creating and marketing a superior product at a low cost, we classify as market entrepreneurs. So it was looking back at history saying, well, there's really bad businessmen, but there's also some really beneficial ones, and there's terrible unions, and there's good unions. So how do we have to look at every individual case? And it actually turns out we can have a historian give us a principal difference with regard to how we see the benefits of companies operating in a historical sense.
Yeah, I think the important distinction, that's a great book, by the way. Highly recommend for anybody interested in the liberty movement. The distinction between a political and the market entrepreneur is absolutely crucial to make, because how many politicians do we have today who've all gotten rich, right? How many presidents leave office after 10xing their personal wealth, but they've never started a business, they've never engaged in any sort of entrepreneurial activities whatsoever. And it really is a difference between parasitism and production, and that I think is really the point that Folsom's trying to drive home in that book. And that's the important point that I hope all the readers get from that book. You know, the idea of politics as a profession it's such a turnoff. It's so disgusting to me. It's like, you're literally going to make your living off of parasitism and like a leech. And to me, that is completely unacceptable. It's the opposite of entrepreneurship, right? Entrepreneurs are creating wealth, and politicians are extracting it from us. So that's a great book, and I really hope everybody out there reads it.
Oh, me too. I absolutely enjoyed it. What is your number four historical lie?
My number four biggest myth is the Federal Reserve Act. And this, again, I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, 1913, this essentially compelled all banks to hold their gold deposits in the central bank. And essentially that left everyday Americans had to put their wealth in the hands of the state, which obviously is not a good idea. We all see how that worked out. The fact of the matter is that central banking is unstable, right? And the whole excuse for the Federal Reserve Act was that, you know, we have competing currencies and competing banks, and you have these bank runs and these panics, and don't worry, let the government control everything. Have confidence and faith in the central bank, and this way we'll reduce we'll get rid of bank runs and panics. But actually, if you look at it in reverse, in hindsight, looking at it today, it's the exact opposite, right? We have increased frequency and severity of recessions, as opposed to the time when we had competing banks and currencies. So, you know, one of the problems was, let's say you and I are, let's say I'm a banker and you don't think too highly of me. And again, let's assume we're in a free market system. If I write out receipts for people who have deposited gold at my bank, right, and then they say, oh, this is from the bank of Sal Mayweather, Keith. Say, I don't like that guy, Sal. I don't trust him. He's a liar. I know him. He's no good. I'm not going to accept this receipt. The central bank used it's sort of inseparable from the nature of competition, but they used that as an impetus to induce fear in Americans and give them a false sense of hope by saying, once you put your faith in the central government, that sort of stuff will end. You won't have to worry about that anymore. And we see the exact opposite. Now people are losing faith in the dollar, and they're turning to things like Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, and precious metals, emerging market currencies, and different sorts of assets and securities. It's a mass exodus from the dollar, and we are really living in the end times of the fiat monetary system. And it's all a result of Bretton Woods, and it's only going to get worse. It's only going to get worse. So the Federal Reserve Act, I think, is a pretty easy myth to debunk. Even if you just look at a quick chart of the, like, for example, if you look at a chart of the price of gasoline in dollars, it goes up and up and up. That's not because the price of gasoline is going up. It's because of the price of the dollar is going down. If you look at the same chart of the price of gasoline when it's priced in gold, it's a flat and stable line. So it's not that prices are rising, it's that the currency is being devalued. So that's my number four biggest myth. I think any individual who has half a brain nowadays could see that you know, they should at least have some inkling as to the scam that is fiat money.
I know you're very big into Bitcoin and alternative currencies. This is terrific because people who are not willing to admit they've been wrong about the legitimacy of the state actually have an economic incentive to sort of join us and counteract anything that the state is engaging in. What would be a brief introduction that you would give to someone who's not familiar at all with alternative currencies?
You broke up a little bit there, but I think you asked for an introduction to alternative currencies. And one of the things I really recommend for people to check out is read Hayek, because Hayek is just absolutely wonderful in this regard. He has a great little book. I think it's called The Denationalization of Currency or something along those lines. The name escapes me, but essentially the idea is that, and I have an article, by the way, coming out in the next few days on this that I'll DM to you on Twitter. But the whole idea essentially is, why keep your money in a currency that's going to be where politicians can siphon off wealth from you? Not only that, but then they use that wealth they siphon from you to fund welfarism, warfarism. Frankly, they use it to fund domestic terrorism here at home. And to me, it doesn't make any sense. Not only is it immoral in that regard, but it's also not pragmatic or practical, right? If I keep my money in sound money, if I keep my wealth in sound money, it grows. If I keep my wealth in fiat currency, it becomes devalued. And like I said, they use it for immoral purposes. So that's really the main gist of why I like alternative currencies. My favorite ones, obviously, I use cryptocurrency for exchange purposes, and I use precious metals for savings. That's only because cryptocurrencies are a little bit too volatile right now to be a real store of value yet. But I think that as mass adoption increases, they will start to assume some of the secondary functions of money, like value storage, credit facilitation, unit of account, stuff like that. But the key is to having an efficient medium of exchange that can compete with fiat currencies. My favorite one to use is Bitcoin Cash, but I encourage people to use whatever cryptocurrency or precious metal that they find convenient. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if tomorrow we wake up and everybody's back to trading salt or cattle or wheat, I understand the coincidence of double wants and stuff like that, and there are some issues there, but that's a lot better than what we have today, where, like I said, we're funding the famine in Yemen or military exercises in the South China Sea, which are provoking the world's biggest military other than ourselves. So all of this stuff are, it all goes back to the dollar, right? It all goes back to the devaluation of the dollar. That's how they're able to come up with this money. They could never tax you for it, right? Because if they taxed us for all this money, there would be rebellion in the streets tomorrow if they were taking 90% of our wealth. So the way that they get around this is it's through hidden taxation. It's through inflation, which is the most evil form of taxation. And as an agorist, as a counter-economist, we're looking for alternatives to promote to individuals. And I think the easiest sell right now is cryptocurrency and, like I said, precious metals for savings. So that's basically, in a nutshell, my take on alternative currencies.
So yeah, the Federal Reserve one is a very good example. There was actually one of the guys involved in the Jekyll Island meeting in 1910, Frank Vanderlip, actually wrote about how they had this secret plot, but it's not a secret anymore because now we have this Federal Reserve that's going to stop panics and recessions. So they actually admit it, and we still get called far-right crazy theorists by Cass Sunstein, even though, you know, we cite primary documents and sources. He talks about his nudge feelings, and we're the theorists. So, yeah, of course, it's the opposite.
And there's a great little book, too, by the way. The name of the author, it's on the top of my tongue, I can't think of it. It's called The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Yeah, G. Edward Griffin.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah, he has done a great job documenting that. So, my next one is, I will try not to make this too long. This is the myth that Herbert Hoover sat back and did nothing in the in a minor recession, which then caused the Great Depression. So
that's a good one.
So here is this is a book by Bob Murphy, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Year. Here is Paul Krugman. But even as Washington tries to rescue the economy, the nation will be reeling from the actions of 50 Herbert Hoovers, state governors who are slashing spending in a time of recession, often at the expense of both their most vulnerable constituents at the nation's economic of the nation's economic future. So the word Herbert Hoover is loosely used to describe a non-interventionist politician who just sort of sits back and lets things go to hell. Now, what Bob Murphy does a great job of is he has big pages to give you graphs, so you can actually just look at the numbers, that there was a 42% increase in the budget from the time that Herbert Hoover took office to when he left. As far as not intervening in other ways, Murphy lists a number of things. Wage controls, which didn't occur in 1920, and we had a small recession there that was dealt with without there being a Great Depression. Hoover crippled international trade with the Smoot-Hawley tariff. Murphy cites exports in 1929 being $7 billion and in 1932 being $2.5 billion. Now, this is not exactly what you'd expect for exports, because, you know, other countries might not be having the same thing you're having. So really, they're the ones who would be doing all the buying. Your exports might increase. But because of the Smoot-Hawley tariff and protectionism that started retaliatory tariffs, it made everyone worse off. He then was a big taxer with the Revenue Act of 1932. This personal income taxes increased from 1.5% to 5%, a new range up from 4% to 8%, and it just increased from there as far as your income went. Personal expenditures were sharply reduced and earned credit of 25% eliminated. Surtaxes were raised enormously from a maximum of 25% to 63%. Corporate income tax, 12% to 13.5%. And it just goes up from there. And then he started the New Deal, which no one cares about, I guess. In 1930, he had a $915 million public works program. It's where we get the Hoover Dam from. It's also where we get the Reconstruction Finance Corporation from. In the first 5 months, it spent $1 billion. This is at a time when federal income is about $6 billion a year. He gave $1 billion to the banks and the railroads. So Hoover, not an isolationist, a statist interventionist. One more thing in here about Social Security that Murphy mentions. I know it's off topic, but this is great. Senator Bennett Clark offered an amendment to the Social Security Act that would have allowed employers to opt out of the system so long as they offered their employees pensions with benefits. Senator Robert Lafayette, a strong supporter of the original version, objected to offering citizens a choice among plans. If we shall adopt the Clark Amendment, the government having determined to set up a federal system of old age insurance will provide, in its own bill creating that system, competition, which in the end may destroy the federal system. It would be inviting and encouraging competition with its own plan, which ultimately would undermine and destroy it. So
they understood Hoover, how they understood how weak it was to the competitive market.
Yeah. And that's one of the big things today, that they're like, oh, well, we got to take care of the elderly. I mean, they don't have an income, which I'm all about taking care of them just voluntarily and letting them opt out.
Well, you know, it's funny because in every single aspect of the market that is socialized, we're experiencing a shortage, right? And in terms of retirement funds, right now we have a shortage of retirement funds because it's been socialized. That's why folks our age aren't going to receive any Social Security, because it's a giant Ponzi scheme. And if we actually had a little bit of competition, then perhaps we wouldn't be in this mess. You know, going back to your original point, though, I think it's interesting what you said about Herbert Hoover, because even today, like you said earlier, even today, they'll hold up a politician and say, oh, look, he's the next Herbert Hoover. If you don't do anything, you're the next Herbert Hoover. That's how they got George Bush and who was it, Ben Bernanke at the time, to bail out all the banks and Goldman Sachs and all of their crooked friends on Wall Street, because, oh, well, if you don't do that, you're going to wind up like Herbert Hoover. Who wants to have a historical legacy like Hoover? But in that book, there's a wonderful job explaining that actually Hoover, it wasn't his fault. And I actually have some FDR stuff on my list today that we're going to go through too, but just in terms of economics, I don't think the Great Depression was FDR's fault, but he did make it a lot worse, and he did exacerbate it, and he lengthened it by all of those programs that, you know, I'm sure, you know, you went over a couple of them, I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, but that only made the problem worse and worse and worse. So Hoover really did pretty good relative to most presidents during times of economic crisis, and Roosevelt was the one who sort of dragged things out. But who gets the credit for the resolution? Roosevelt. Who gets the blame? Hoover. So it's to be expected amongst the political class.
It's amazing that instead of in-depth arguments, you just have comparisons. We don't like the guy? Call him Hoover if he's domestic. If we don't like him overseas, well, he's Hitler. All right. That covers both domestic policy right. And foreign policy.
Propaganda 101.
We're good to go. Sal, number three, historical myth.
The number three biggest historical myth that I have is the Lusitania. So the Lusitania was a cruise liner that was sunk, and it was the impetus for the U.S. getting involved in World War I. And the story behind this is really disgusting. And the more you read up on it, the more sick to your stomach you get. And we all know how terrible of a man Woodrow Wilson was. And this, no, very few incidents in during his presidency really draw that out better than Lusitania, because it was, like I said, it was a civilian cruise liner, but the Americans were secretly shipping weapons to the British on civilian cruise liners. Wilson did this on purpose because he knew that if there was a big loss of civilian life, he would have a pretty good impetus for drawing us into the war. And he was right. It gets worse than that, though. Germany tried to warn not even the American government, the American people. They said, hey, guys, there are weapons on this ship, and we're going to sink it. They even went so far as to take out advertisements in all of the various newspapers around America. But Wilson censored these warnings from the newspapers. And I think there was one of them actually got through his censor. I think it was like in the Des Moines Register or something like that. There is actually a famous article saying, hey, guys, don't get on this boat. Take an advertisement taken out by the Germans. Hey guys, don't take it out. Don't get on this boat. We're going to sink it. So sure enough, they did, and that was the impetus for drawing us into the war. But it was all a crock of lies, for lack of a better term. And really, the problem, the overarching problem with not even Lusitania, but getting involved in World War I, is that it tipped the scales so heavily in favor of the Allies. That, and I think Rothbard said this, that it changed the outcome of the war from a negotiated treaty to an unconditional surrender. That allowed for the Treaty of Versailles, which in turn, we all know, put a heavy hand on the Germans, which led to the rise of nationalism and Hitler and so on and so forth. Next thing you know, you have the Holocaust. Now, all of this comes back to Wilson, and a point that I've always personally felt, I've always thought interesting about this, and I've never read this in a book. This is just my own thoughts here. Wilson's father was a Confederate soldier, and it seems to me that even if you look at nowadays, most of the most soldiers come from the southern United States. So it seems to me that Wilson had the idea in his head, well, he was trying to reunify the South, bring them back into the fold of the federal government. And it seems to me that the idea in his head was, well, if we can get these Southerners to fight under the American flag, then they'll consider themselves to be Americans once again. And this was really, in this way, you can almost consider World War I to be part of Reconstruction. And then, obviously, then that brings us back to Lincoln and his Holocaust and stuff like that. So Lusitania is my number three. It was the impetus for World War I. It was a lie. It was the murder of American civilians by an American president, used to draw us into an unjust war, which led to a century of bloodshed and warfare.
Excellent choice. My next one is the origins of the welfare state. There is a general idea that is, it's not even fair to call it a theory, that people will say, well, the reason we have something today is because some time ago, people engaged in debate, discussion, deliberative democracy, and this excellent idea rose to the top, and that's why we've kept it through rational purposes. That's not the case with any of them. Literally, the more you look into them, the worse it is. So it actually started with Otto von Bismarck, going back to the 1880s. This is a summary from Tom Palmer in his book After the Welfare State. Bismarck waged a lengthy political war on the free trade classical liberals in Germany. Bismarck ushered in the German welfare state through a series of compulsory insurance schemes for accidents, health, disability, old age, which he promoted and enacted in the 1880s, calling these measures state socialism. Bismarck wanted to make the workers feel more dependent on the state and therefore on him. Bismarck confirmed that the purpose of state socialism. Germany needed to dominate Europe. Whoever has a pension for his old age is far more content and far easier to handle than one who has no such prospect. Look at the difference between a private servant and a servant in the chancellery or at a court. The latter will put up with much more because he has a pension to look forward to. I will consider it a great advantage when we have 700,000 small pensioners drawing their annuities from the state, especially if they belong to those classes who otherwise do not have so much to lose by an upheaval and erroneously believe that they can actually gain much by it. So it was literally used to keep people from resisting him and the Kaiser.
It's incredible how honest they were back then. Like they didn't even try to hide it.
Yeah, yeah. And you can see that in a number of other things for... the example is escaping me. But yes, it's much more about being open at the time and then lying about it in the future. Or you have the reverse of that, where now they're like, well, we start wars to bring democracy to places.
Right. Yeah,
but at
right.
the time, it's like, Gaddafi's giving his troops Viagra. Assad is gassing people. Saddam has nukes that he got from Niger. And Bin Laden is, you know, in Afghanistan.
Well, when you talk about how Bismarck instituted mandatory insurance programs and referred to it as state socialism, isn't it interesting that we have mandatory health insurance in this country? We have Obamacare, but that's not socialism, right? That's not state socialism, right? That's different now. Now it's for the benefit of all Americans. It's so that you have health care. So it's not about dependency, like Bismarck said. It's about benevolence. It's about the politicians trying to help us. It's very upsetting, all of the political nonsense. But Bismarck was a particularly evil character in the story of history, because as Lincoln was consolidating political power in the United States, Bismarck was doing the same thing in Europe. And really, the combination of those two forces is what led to, like I said, World War One and World War Two and stuff like that. The warfare state, as you're describing. So Bismarck was a particularly bad dude, but it sounds like he was even more honest than our contemporary politicians that we have today. So as bad as he was still better than the Nancy Pelosi's and the Chuck Schumer's and the Mitch McConnell's that we're stuck with today.
Yeah, I mean, look at people's reaction when you give them an idea of, civilians killed by the U.S. invading Iraq, or what's going on in Yemen, or any of the Waco atrocities or anything else. They give you an emotional response. The reason that emotional response is in place is they're genuinely concerned. Without this thing, I wouldn't get education and grandma wouldn't be taken care of. So the fact that that's there really, it allows them to totally see through, you know, this war in Yemen, that there should be nothing else in the news. Trump having COVID is one guy getting a possible illness compared to the mass murder of civilians. It's literally like, let's talk about Jeffrey Dahmer without mentioning that he killed anyone. You know, let's just leave that out. The fact we're talking about anything besides Yemen and Pakistan, the drone war in Pakistan gets nothing. One little bomb goes off in Boston. I'm sorry. The Boston bombing was horrific. My point is it happens once here. We flip out about it for 10 years, which is proportional. But let's take that empathy and extend it across political borders that the British gave us many moons ago.
It's interesting to me that a lot of these neocons, there's been this outpouring of support for Trump because he has coronavirus, but there is no similar outpouring of support when he drops a Moab on a wedding of 19 or 31 pine nut farmers, however many civilians he killed. There was no outcry when that happened. but just because this guy caught a cold, the neocons are all up in arms. That just goes to show you the level of indoctrination, just how brainwashed they are. It's become the point of worship. We've progressed past respect, and we're now at the point where they're worshiping these people. So, I mean, it's bonkers to me. It's crazy that – hats off to the public schools, though, for pulling this off, because to indoctrinate a people this heavily, you really need decades and decades and decades of effective propaganda. And that wouldn't be possible without the public schools. But one more point on the welfarism, the start of the welfare state. You know, we already discussed the Federal Reserve Act and how that sort of finances welfarism. There's a philosopher, I use air quotes because I don't actually consider him a philosopher. I think he's a moron. But check out, there's a guy named John Rawls. I can't think of the name of his book.
A Theory of Justice?
Yeah, okay, yeah, so you're familiar with it. Yeah, and he sort of comes up with all these convoluted justifications for stealing money from us and giving them to other people. So if the listeners out there, they want to get a better grasp on some of these leftist, communist, backwards arguments, Rawls is sort of a must-read, and he was pretty influential on Obama. So, and also, I think Rawls was influenced by a lot of the stuff that Bismarck did in the old-school welfare. So check out John Rawls.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that he, you know, worked at Harvard, most popular philosopher in the philosophical field, and he does two things that are just so blatantly inconsistent. One, he talks about the need for redistribution within a country, as right. though he's saying, but we can't have these arbitrary rules. Let's have principles of philosophy starting from a veil of ignorance. Well, but then he That's doesn't right. apply it to like Haiti or Argentina or anything else. And then never explains why this group called government has the right to forcibly take and redistribute money, but not this group called SalTheAgorist.com or right. this group called the church or this group called the temple. It's always the same one. And what happens is they just have idiot stooges who they put up there to justify things they already want. So the masses can be like, oh, yeah, this is the reason that I have for it. That they just so they have a little something to lean back on.
Or how about like the Gambinos or the Mafia? That's my favorite example to use because they're so similar to the state apparatus, right? I mean, John Gotti in New York, I'm from New York, so John Gotti was sort of like the president of New York in like the 80s and the 90s and stuff. And he was much more benevolent than Bill de Blasio and Andrew Cuomo are. He was much nicer to the people. If you were broke, John Gotti would buy you a turkey for Thanksgiving. Bill de Blasio takes your house away from you. So the Mafia was much more benevolent, but it's sort of the same exact kind of thing. So if the state can do it, why can't the Mafia compete with them? That's why one of the things I always say was that RICO, the RICO Act in the 70s, was sort of when the state could plant their victory flag, their mission accomplished flag, because that's when they sort of drove off the last of the competition.
Yeah. Well, what is your second biggest historical myth?
So my number two biggest myth, this is a big one, excuse me, a big one. This is Pearl Harbor. One of the biggest lies in American history, up until this point in American history, the country was by and large non-interventionist, and it was Pearl Harbor that sort of dragged us away from that. You know, up until Pearl Harbor, I think it was almost 80% of the country was against entering the war, and I think it was the great historian Ralph Rako, who you and I spoke about last time, who said that Roosevelt dragged us kicking and screaming into this war. And the story of Pearl Harbor gets worse and worse and worse the more you learn about it. I've got a couple points here. Number one, FDR withheld vital information from the United States. We were receiving cables from, we had intercepted cables from the Japanese, essentially saying, hey, look, our boats are on their way to Pearl Harbor right now. And when that information got back to Roosevelt, his response to that was to declare the North Pacific Sea vacant. In other words, no U.S. ships could be in that area. We could not impede the Japanese advance on Pearl Harbor. So this begs the question, why would a sitting president want this? The only possible explanation is that he didn't want the Japanese ships to be discovered by the Americans and stopped before they got to Pearl Harbor. Also, the Japanese ambassador, the Japanese emperor sent the Japanese ambassador to Washington with a declaration of war in his hand to deliver to the White House. But he was turned away. He was turned away by the White House. So there was no surprise about Pearl Harbor. It was Admiral Kimmel who testified at Congress after the fact that he said it was that Washington was giving him an affirmative misrepresentation of the facts. In other words, this is a polite way of saying FDR lied to him about this. Really, it gets worse and worse. There was some backwards channel that he did receive some sort of information that there was a threat on Pearl Harbor, but Washington contacted Kimmel, who was in charge of Pearl Harbor, and he said, "Don't take that seriously. That's just a rumor. That's not true." So we see how that all wound up, and to me, again, this goes back to all the other myths that we're discussing. Lusitania is another one. The fact that an American president would sacrifice all of these lies to draw us into a conflict that we didn't want just really shows you the nature of politicians and the political class for what it is. Another tidbit here is that Roosevelt was always a Navy guy. He loved boats. He was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy at some point, and he had this whole fascination with boats. And I think, and I don't remember the whole story off the top of my head. I don't have the book in front of me, but I believe he even pulled some of those ships out to sea, pulled them out of harbor, and only left a couple of them for the Japs to bomb and attack because he liked those ships. Those were cool to him, right? He wanted to see those ships survive. This is a sick and twisted, demented man, sacrificing Americans so that he could draw himself into this war to try to make himself into this great president. Another final point on this that I would be remiss if I didn't mention is the role that Churchill, one of history's great villains, played in all this and sort of whispering in Roosevelt's ear the whole time and trying to draw him into the war, which is, by the way, a similar role that Churchill played in World War I. When Churchill was in the British Navy, he was also in Wilson's ear, trying to draw us into the war. And, as Rako said, Churchill was a man without principles. He was only a man with a love of war. And that's sort of borne out in Pearl Harbor.
Sure. And then we have Churchill's own diary where he said, "Yeah, I spoke with FDR in Newfoundland, and he's all in for the Allied. He's trying to provoke Germany." So there was a policy of provocation in place.
Meanwhile, he's telling the American people that we're going to remain neutral.
Exactly.
Right.
Unbelievable. He said something like, "I won't send your daughters into war, and we had nothing to fear but fear itself."
It's right. Like, it was all a lie. It was all a lie. And, another thing that Roosevelt did that people don't thank God it didn't hit the news because it never actually came to any fruition, but he would actually send American boats into Japanese waters on suicide missions with the hope that they would get blown up. And the idea was, well, then we wouldn't have to have a Pearl Harbor, right? We can lose one ship instead of losing a whole base. Once he realized that the Japanese weren't taking the bait, and he did this a few times, once he realized that they weren't taking the bait, he had to resort to Pearl Harbor. A really disgusting, a twisted individual, FDR. If any of your listeners are out there who are interested in reading more, there's a few good books by John Flynn, Country Squire in the White House. Was probably one of the better ones that I've read that I like by Flynn, and he really goes through what a for lack of better term, what a liar Roosevelt was and a conniver he was.
Oh, of course. My next one is by Tom Woods. He gives a great summary in 33 Questions About American History. Was the Wild West really so wild? Now, this is important because, just like how they just have, people for when they disagree with you, "Oh, well, that's what Hoover did." Well, anytime you try holding the state to the same standards you'd hold anyone else to, that would just turn into the Wild West. There's already this built-in assumption, so they put a sticker on any idea instead of having to address it. He gives a number of sources here. Now, it's difficult to know what happened in the Wild West, but the point is that it's difficult for us to know the truth, and it's difficult for people who believe it was this terrible, evil, wild place for them to know the truth. So he cites Terry Anderson and P.J. Hill's The Not-So-Wild Wild West, saying, people devised private mechanisms to allocate rights to land and resources like gold and water, resolve disputes, and to enforce laws. He cites Frontier Violence, Another Look, published in 1976, Cattle Towns, published in 1983, and Lethal Imagination, Violence and Brutality in American History, 1999. These are all studies that concluded the Wild West was not wild in a place like Dodge City, only having five killings in 1878. Roger McGrath wrote Gunfighters, Highwaymen, and Vigilantes, where he more or less makes the case that when everybody has a gun on his hip, they tend to avoid confrontation because it was very costly to engage in conflict, costly to you especially. It's one thing if governments are going around knowing that only their civilians are going to get killed, but when it's like, okay, I'm going to get shot, well, there's a big incentive for people to cooperate. He discusses wagon train governments, which were basically voluntary agreements that occurred on railroads because it's hard. It's a little easier when everyone knows where you are, but when you're moving 100 miles, adds another hurdle. They did a lot of sharing more than dividing with regard to information of how to settle disputes. They erected a legal system, punished crimes against life and property, which, of course, any society would do. You don't need a state for that. We did that in high school when people got out of control at parties. I think we can all do that without a state. In 3 years, writes P.J. Hill, more than 200,000 people migrated to California, most of them trying to get rich quick. If there was ever a recipe for chaos, this would seem to be one. People of varied backgrounds, ethnicities, all armed and seeking a valuable resource. But mining camps quickly evolved rules for establishing mining claims and for judging disputes. Men of vastly different backgrounds who were complete strangers and thus possessed no pre-existing community camaraderie. They still had a district-wide meetings, or they had elected juries to settle disputes as well. And look, as far as juries go, they can be there can be, you know, corruption and ignorance. The whole point is you don't have a group that has a total different moral standard where, I mean, every criticism you can have of competition between groups is an example of why one group shouldn't have a monopoly. So the Wild West is a great historical myth.
Yeah, no doubt. A few points here, and I think you brought up one of them. When everybody, an armed society is a polite society, right? So that accounts for the... There's less violence in the Wild West back then than there is in South Side of Chicago today, or Skid Row in Los Angeles, or in the Bronx, or in Newark, New Jersey, or in any of these places. Though I'd rather live in the Wild West than any of these places. You have a much higher rate of survival, a much longer lifespan in the Wild West than you would in any of these urban areas where the socialists rule the day. Second point is the gold standard, right? After the Civil War, we sort of had a return to sound money. Congress amazingly got moved away from Lincoln's fiat currency and moved back towards sound money. And that's why Bob Higgs has a little, I think his thesis when he got a doctorate, it was like the transformation of the American economy, like 1855 to, you know, whatever, 1900 or something like that. And he goes through how the economy grew so much during this time, based on the fact that we had sound money and a sort of non-interventionist foreign policy up until around the Cleveland years. So check that reading out. The third point in regards to the Wild West, a lot of these outlaws that we read about were old Confederate soldiers who were trying to get away from the Union, right? These were folks who were sort of outcast because they were traitors, right? They were branded as traitors and they had fought against the Union, and they were men without a country. So they were just sort of left to wander around the West, and they became these sort of Jesse James-type characters and Billy the Kid and stuff. But they weren't necessarily bad folks. They were induced into violence. They were indoctrinated into violence by the Union, by Lincoln, and that's a pretty good segue into my number one myth, which I don't want to jump the gun here, but I was going to say my number one biggest myth was going to be the Emancipation Proclamation, which was, I don't think there's any doubt in my mind, it's the biggest lie told in history. It had nothing, first of all, Lincoln never freed a slave a day in his life. In fact, Lincoln put more slaves in chains than he did free them. The Emancipation Proclamation, people celebrate it, right? We celebrate Juneteenth, all this stuff, but nobody ever actually reads the document. If they read the Emancipation Proclamation, they would know right off the bat what a lie it is, because it only applied to states in the South, right? Well, the South didn't acknowledge Lincoln's rule. They didn't acknowledge the legitimacy of Lincoln's presidency. So they didn't listen to anything that he said. His edicts over the South had no bearing. Meanwhile, there were still four states in the North that did have slaves. So the slaves that he could have freed, he didn't. They were left in bondage. But it was the slaves in the South that he tried to direct this emancipation to. And all that did was encourage blacks to sort of rise up and kill their masters. And it was the Emancipation Proclamation was a war measure, it was a war act, not a humanitarian act. And its effect was to induce violence and encourage these slaves to rise up and kill their masters. And that actually worked in some cases. There was a lot of violence because of this. They were encouraged to do this. And the result of that was that the South was sort of bequeathed with this legacy of Jim Crow and racism for the next 100 years. And all of that comes from the Emancipation Proclamation. Lincoln had a chance early on in the war. General Fremont was in Missouri, and he had the opportunity. He freed all the slaves in Missouri. He made an edict right there. All the slaves are free. And Lincoln forced him to reverse that emancipation. So when I tell people that Lincoln put more blacks in chains than he did free them, that's what I'm talking about. He didn't free Southern slaves, right, because they didn't listen to him, but he did enslave the blacks in Missouri. So he was a slave driver, Lincoln. He was an avowed white supremacist who said multiple times he had no inclinations to tinker with the institution of slavery. Multiple times he said this. He's documented on the record saying that he thought that the white race was superior to the black race. There's a great book by Kirkpatrick Sale, who I actually had on my show to discuss this. He's got it's just a little booklet. I highly, highly recommend it. It's called Emancipation Hell. And one of the things that Sale writes is that in 1888, Frederick Douglass returned to the South, and he wrote that the emancipation was a quote, stupendous fraud perpetrated on the world. And I think if we look at the current state of not only black Americans, but specifically black Americans, we can see that emancipation never happened, right? We're still in chains today. It's just those chains aren't, it's not chattel slavery, it's tax slavery and conscription and fiat slavery and stuff like this. They've just changed the method of slavery. So that to me is the biggest myth ever, because it was used to justify Lincoln's genocide. Up until this point, the war was publicly known that it was about tariffs. It was nothing to do with a moral issue. And then when he issued the emancipation, then it became a moral thing. Northerners were, people have to understand at the time, Northerners were very racist. The whole country was white supremacists. You know, nowadays they throw around the term white supremacist. There are very few actual white supremacists in the country today. But in the antebellum South in those days, in 1850s and 60s, everybody was a white supremacist. That because it was ignorance, right? People weren't as smart as they were today. So Northerners were not willing to send their children and their husbands and the head of the household off to die for black people because they didn't like them. So the idea that they were willing to fight a war over slavery is absurd. They were willing to fight a war for tariffs. That's what it was. It was about money and finances and taxes. It was only when that excuse became tired and dried up that Lincoln had to shift the narrative into a moral case. That was, and you know, by the way, the Civil War resulted in 700,000 American deaths. you know, I said earlier when we were talking about Vietnam, there was only 60,000 deaths in Vietnam. So it was the bloodiest war in American history, bar none, and it was all based on a lie. So to me, that was a big, and by the way, like we said earlier, the Civil War was the precedent for the bloodshed and the horror of the 20th century. If there weren't 700,000 Americans dead, if that wasn't normalized under Lincoln and the Civil War, then World War One and Two never would have been possible. So that's my biggest myth.
You know, it is funny to hear Stephen Colbert have, you know, a million viewers and say, Americans are have never been this divided before. This is unprecedented. Do you not know about, I mean, anything, the Civil War, just to name one? I always ask people, because it's not like a little thing. It's that was the most divided ever. And nothing comes close to that. But everything has to be, you know, a total moral outrage. Do you think that basically the nationalism that people have today, America first, is in principle no different than whites first? And I don't care about blacks, but I just care. I got to take care of my whites first. That's more or less in principle making decisions and having preferences based on an accident of birth, which is almost nationalism.
Exactly. To me, it's crazy to me that people can be proud of traits or characteristics that they were born with. You didn't earn that. You did nothing to create that. You didn't. It's like it's, you know, to be proud of something that you didn't earn and that you were born with is really the epitome of what they say. Oh, when they accuse someone of being born with a silver spoon, that's what they're talking about. And I make no assumptions about white privilege or anything like that. That's not what I'm talking about. To me, it's just crazy to say to be proud of something, like I said, that you didn't earn and that you were given.
Now, my final myth is another one from Tom Woods. What made American wages rise? He says, starting off with a thought experiment. Suppose some catastrophe should occur today that disseminates the productivity of American labor. So all American factories are gone. Well, what would happen? He says, this economy is capable of far less production than it was before the catastrophe. So it's not that we have 40 hours of a work week because there was a law written down by politicians. The pharaohs of Egypt could have written down 40 hours, right? Or in the year 1300, they could have said 40 hours or 10 hours a week, but people would have starved to death. So Woods actually equates this, much like Deirdre McCluskey, who adds the social honor aspect of becoming an entrepreneur, seeking the well-being of your fellow man through meeting consumer demand. He approaches it from the investment and entrepreneurial aspect. He's saying that a productive economy allows us to increase the number of people satisfied by capital equipment. The goods they might have purchased and enjoyed in the past simply do not exist in the necessary quantities to satisfy everyone. So because the economy was only, you could work 10 hours and only produce a small amount, that wasn't a lot to sell. But now when you work that same amount of time, you can produce a lot more. He says investing in a forklift is the example that he has. If there were no forklifts and they had to use only their hands to lift stuff and move it around, you'd be able to do 1/100th of what you do today, and you'd get 1/100th of the wages because your business has 1/100th of the customers that they could supply. He says firms can now produce many times more goods than before and at considerably lower costs. He says here's one that he uses. He says, at the very best, a redistribution of wealth or income would have been useless as a means of alleviating the poverty of the past. So if you take what they say now about Bezos, oh, what if we took all his $200 billion with through taxation? Well, the state would spend it in 2 days, right? And then you'd have you would have killed the golden goose that's given us Amazon, which, you know, increases poor people's access to products and services. Walmarts are ugly. That needs to be improved. Walmart's done more to help the poor than I could ever dream of. He says it's about reinvesting in capital and increasing worker productivity that gives us an increase in the supply of goods that the economy is capable of producing. also you need competition, because if you could be the smartest person with all this equipment, but if you got nowhere else to go, then I might as well pay you a penny an hour. So yeah, that's my final historical myth.
Well, doesn't that speak highly to a lot of the nonsense that the state spews about automation, right? Yeah. They tell us to fear automation, but that is exactly what you're describing. That's how an economy grows, right? Rather than having 100 people do a job, you can build a machine to do that job. Now those 100 people can be employed doing something more productive, right? You know, think about how many jobs we can get back if, you know, everybody stopped using the computer or something to type letters, and we all had to hire calligraphers. Or instead of driving a car, we had to hire a horse and buggy driver. Imagine how many jobs we can get back. But that's not a productive society. That's the opposite of a productive society. And that's why it's so interesting to me to see the state sort of fight back against this technology. You know, Rothbard writes in chapter 10 of Science, Technology, and Government exactly this, that I think he ties into the elasticity of goods a little bit. But essentially, the idea is that when something gets automated, not only does that create it creates new employment, new wages for individuals, but those are higher wages in newer sectors of the economy. Newer, higher paying jobs in different sectors of the economy. So to me, it's crazy that we fight against this stuff and we allow the state to sort of make these obtuse arguments that are so easily proven wrong. I mean, you know, like I said, you want to go back to calligraphers and horse and buggy drivers, but for some reason, like I said, after 60 years of public school, all of a sudden that argument becomes a much easier sell.
Absolutely. Sal the Agoras, thank you so much for your time. Your website is saltheagoras.com, correct?
Yes, sir. Saltheagoras.com. I've got the blog at newlibertarian.io, and you can find everything from saltheagoras.com, though.
Well, thank you to everyone for watching Keith and I Don't Tread on Anyone.